I was thinking to begin with a review for two reasons. One, when there's a series of subject matter, almost always there's some people that weren't there for part one or part two, and you're doing a later part, and they'd be like, what's going on? So it's a review for that reason. Then a second reason is the subject matter is not just information, it's the methodology or the systematic way in which is doing what he's doing, being an acharya for not just for his time, but for generations and generations and generations. In essence, he's writing a commentary on the entire Srimad Bhagavatam and on Vedanta Sutra without calling it a commentary on the Bhagavatam and Vedanta Sutra. The history, this is the six sandarbhas, commonly, conventionally, they're known as sat sandarbhas or six sandarbhas, but actually it's the Bhagavat sandarbha, all six together. And it's a type of commentary. It's a sandarbha type. That's the word sandarbha. This is review. The word sandarbha means, here it is, weaving. And he uses terminology in this, like in the introductory verses that we're used to, but he uses them in a different way, like sambandha. We think of sambandha and we hear it again and again and again, so we gradually learn what we hear again and again. And sambandha means the Lord, who is the source of everything. Has a relationship with him. And the things that emanate from him, they have a relationship with each other. Like the living entity and matter and, there's a relationship ultimately with the Supreme. He has another use of this term, sambandha. It's the subject and the words. There's a relationship between the subject, Bhagavan, and the text. So he's weaving the texts or the verses to illuminate the subject of the text, Krishna, or Bhagavan, as in the Bhagavat Sandarbha. Anyway, it's a weaving of verses to give a comprehensive presentation on Lord Chaitanya's philosophy. It's simultaneously a comprehensive summary of our Sampradaya's teachings and the main themes of Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's what it is. And we're going to be discussing part of one of those six sandarbhas, the Tattva Sandarbha, because Gopi Pranadana very kindly translated it. And this is his overall objective. Jiva Goswami is a follower, a worshipper, and a lover of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He wants to share with the world, especially his main audience, intended audience, are the scholars of his time. It's written in that kind of language, the approach that he's using. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching is the highest philosophy. So he has these three strategies. The first is in the Tattva-sandarbha pramana section. We discussed this word pramana and prameya. Anybody can remember the meaning? Pramana means?
Method of understanding or attaining knowledge.
Yeah. Method or means of attaining knowledge, evidence or proof of something. So pramana. And so of all the different methods of knowing something or means of knowing something or evidence to verify something, Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest. We won't review all that. It's going to probably take several sessions. But systematically, he goes through very logically and methodically. Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest means of knowing something. Valid source of knowledge is another kind of dictionary-like definition. So that's the first strategy, which he does in half of this little book here. Tattva-sandarbha is the smallest of the six. But what's in the first half of that first of the six covers what's item number one. But it's very important. And then much of the rest of the Sandarbhas is covering this. Srimad Bhagavatam is teaching Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. So if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. Logically. So then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is the highest. So to accomplish, I wanted to go over this again, particularly this part, because I don't feel like I was running. I was running instead of going slowly. So going more slowly, we're going to start with, what is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy? What is the main message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? That question was asked by Lord Mongol yesterday. When you meet a drunk, what do you tell him? If somebody does ask you in one sentence, what's your philosophy? What is Lord Chaitanya's philosophy? The absolute truth. There's one verse that's about, it's one sentence long, and it's made up of about six compound words, and it's like really, really long. And Jiva Goswami, I was looking for it, I couldn't find it. Maybe I'll find it for tomorrow evening. But, the different elements that make up the absolute truth. But very concisely, the absolute truth is a person, a supreme person, who is possessed of innumerable and inconceivable potencies, one of which is the living entity, and all living entities in their highest state of consciousness is awakening their natural love for that Supreme Person through the process of bhakti yoga, a loving devotional service. So that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. The means to do that, there's details and details, but that's Abhideya. The main philosophy is, just put in simple language, Bhagavan. God is a person, and implied in that is multiple things. Unlimited, inconceivable potencies. So that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching. And what he does in the following Sandarbhas, particularly Bhagavat Sandarbha, Paramatma Sandarbha, and Krishna Sandarbha, is he lays out what the Bhagavatam says in what it were core passages of the Bhagavatam that illustrate those features of Bhagavan and his expansion as the Paramatma, and in his ultimate feature as Krishna in Vrindavan. And then he gets into Bhakti Sandarbha and Priti Sandarbha. Those are the six Sandarbhas. So we've begun the discussion of Vyasadeva's realization because this one, you could say there's many, but three very important ones, sections of the Bhagavatam. So step back. The Bhagavatam's vast. It's Krishna. And Krishna is vast. So to take the essence of what the Bhagavatam is and very carefully analyze the essence of what the Bhagavatam is, then we'll understand the Bhagavatam. So one of those essences, sections, is the Chatur Sloki, the four essential verses. Krishna teaches Brahma. We covered this yesterday. Canto 2, Chapter 9, Texts 33, 4, 5, and 6. That's what Brahma taught, what Krishna taught Brahma, and then Brahma in turn expanded and gave that knowledge to Narada, who then in turn gave it to Vyasa, who wrote Srimad Bhagavatam based upon his realization. So his realization is another very important section. And then Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam in the third chapter, Canto 1, the list of the various incarnations of the Supreme Lord, and amongst them, Krishna is the source of them all. So that's an essence section by its purpose. From that chapter 3, many other verses and are expanding those incarnations of the Lord and the Lord's exchanges of loving dealings with his devotees and protecting his devotees and so forth. So those are three very significant sections which are covered. Some part of them at least are covered in the second half of this book, the Prameya. What does Prameya mean? Huh? Knowable. That which is known through pramana. The evidence. And what do you know through evidence? The understanding. That which is to be known. Means of knowing that which is to be known. The knowable. So, the approach is, by going through these verses carefully, one can understand Vyasadeva's heart or his realization, which is the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam. So we reminded ourselves of Vyasadeva's task of writing the Vedas after compiling the Vedas and condensing the Puranic portion of the Vedas. He was visited by Narada, who explained to him the reason you're not feeling satisfied even after all this work is you have not sufficiently glorified the Supreme Person. You've spoken about fruitive activities exhaustively, but that's not, the living entities are already attracted to fruitive activities, and essentially you've authorized it without sufficiently explaining the purpose, the ultimate purpose of human existence or purpose of life. So sit in a state of trance, fix your mind upon the absolute truth, and that which you realize, then write one literature just on that basis. So that's the Vyasa's realization. Here's the first, Bhakti Yogena Manasi Samyak Praniyate Male Apashat Purusham Purnam Mayam Cha Tadapashrayam. So this first part, that's what he did. Second part is what he saw. And so there's the translation. Jiva Goswami goes through the terms one by one. Bhakti Yogena, the important feature of that is he's emphasizing he was in the state of pure devotion to Krishna, pure devotional service, pure love of God, topmost stage. And pranihite indicates samadhi. He wasn't just like, he wasn't doing sadhana bhakti. He was in samadhi. And he indicates that because that was the instruction of Vyasa to do so from the fifth chapter, meditate in trance, and he did. And so he had these three qualifications. This tells us what we need in order to fully understand Srimad Bhagavatam, as Vyasa to fully envision Krishna and the subject of the Bhagavatam. Amala, a mind that's pure, free from material motive and any attraction to sense enjoyment. Very modest qualification, right? Unalloyed devotion to the Supreme, and samadhi, total meditation. So that's the first part, first half of that verse, verse number 4. And then we discussed what he saw. So he saw Bhagavan. This is, again, going back to strategy. What was the essence of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching, his philosophy? Bhagavan. And what is Bhagavan? Are the features of Bhagavan there, found in the Bhagavatam? Yes. In this, starting with this verse, this is indicating Purusham Purnam. Specifically, Jiva Goswami indicates that he saw the Bhagavan feature. He saw the original feature of Krishna. Because he's making this reference, it's important. This word upadhi down here is going to come several times in this little section, but to speak of the rest of the book. So it's important that we understand it. Because he says Purusham Purnam, or Purna, the complete person, the absolute person, it means Krishna in his full original feature. Distinct from the Paramatma feature, or the Purusha avatars that have a function of material creation. Because of that function of material creation, that's not the fullness of Krishna. The fullness of Krishna is beyond the material creation. You get the idea? Anyone confused? Okay. We're all very clear. Looking for Prahlad, but he's not here. Is he here? Huh?
I thought he was coming.
Okay. I was going to ask Prahlad, is it clear, Prahlad? Yes, Maharaj. I don't want to say no. Okay. Just his methodology is sublime. So we'll just go through the methodology a bit. He refers to two verses where in one case it's making reference to super soul, in the next case it's not. Two successive verses. These are Canto 2, Chapter 3, Text 9, where it's contrasting the process of worship of the demigods, and in contrast, unmixed devotion to the personality of Godhead, or that which can bring one to unmixed devotion. Tivra Bhakti, this text number 10. He refers to the commentary of Sridhar Swami, where in this verse, Sridhar Swami's commentary says, reference in text 9 to the word Purusha means the Supersoul, the Supreme Lord, who has this upadhi or single conditioning limitation of dealing with the material nature. Now, he doesn't directly contact material nature, but his function is to see to the process of creation. And various ways he does that. By his glance, and so many expanding within each of the universes as without all the detail. However, in the second, Shridhar Swami says, in this verse here, text 10, the Purusha here is full or Purnam. Purnam, meaning the supreme, that is without upadhi, and that's Krishna. He's not directly dealing with the material energy. So in any case, his point is what Vyas saw in trance was Krishna in his original feature. So that's Bhagavan. And then he also saw the energies. He saw the external energy, Maya. And here the little explanation is she was under his ashraya or his shelter or his protection, under his full control. He refers to a later verse of this seventh chapter, which is translated, "You are the original personality of God who expand yourself all over the creations and are transcendental to the material energy. You have cast away the effects of the material energy by dint of your spiritual potency. You are always situated in eternal bliss and transcendental knowledge." So now we have three things. Bhagavan, his material potency, but her material potency is at a distance because of his spiritual potency. And thus, Maya has an inferior role to the spiritual potency or the internal potency. And to confirm that understanding, he makes another reference to 2nd Canto, Chapter 7, which states, Maya, feeling ashamed, flees the Lord's direct presence. You're going to see other references, other scriptural indication, the relationship between Maya, or the external potency, and Swarup Shakti, his internal potency. So, that's another reason why I'm going through this. One thing builds on the next thing, builds on the next thing. So, we now have a picture of Bhagavan with his external potency and some indirect reference to his internal potency. Now, down here, this indicates Jiva Goswami wrote a commentary on Tattvasandarbha after writing the Tattvasandarbha. It's called Sarvasambhadani. And there he indicates that although the verse makes no direct reference to Krishna's internal potency, it's implied as much as if you say, if you see the full moon, you see the effulgence around the full moon. See it the opposite way. Is it possible to see the full moon without effulgence around the moon? No. And so you don't say, you know what? 2 nights ago it was a full moon and I also saw the effulgence around the full moon. You don't speak like that. It's implied. You saw the... So using logic, Vyasadeva doesn't state it, but we can understand he saw Radha and Krishna. And we're all the way up to text 31.2. This is a further expansion on the term upadhi, which is going to come up in the next verse also. You'll see. I put in bigger letters this time, a limiting or restricting factor. It's imposed and it restricts. And He gives, as an example, in his commentary, the redness of a crystal, a translucent crystal, and you place beside the translucent crystal a red rose, and you look at the crystal, it may look reddish. You think, oh, the crystal's red. And that's an upadi. It's a translucent crystal. It's not red, but it may look red. So it's a limiting or a restricting factor. That's what an upadi is. A translucent crystal isn't red. Lord Vishnu is not limited by the process of overseeing creation or his function overseeing creation. But because Vishnu oversees creation, unlike Krishna, who doesn't directly involve himself in his expansion, Lord Vishnu does that. Krishna in his fullness is what Vyasa saw. But we're going to hear this word upadi again. That's why I'm mentioning it again. And then the last part of text 31, he then goes into more on the internal potency. He makes a promise to his reader. Later in the Sandarbhas, later in this Sandarbha, he's going to discuss verse number 6, which is the material miseries of the living entity, which are superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. Anarto pashamam sakshad bhakti yogam adhoksajay is how the Sanskrit goes. We'll see that tomorrow evening. But by making reference to it, he is indicating the internal potency is involved in overcoming the external potency. They're distinct. And further in this, after this, few verses later, the Atmarama verse. Atmaramas cha munayo niyagrantha api arukrame. By the process of devotional service, even Atmaramas, who aren't attracted to anything material, become attracted to Krishna through the medium of his devotional service, which is also fully spiritual, distinct from the external potency. I'm going through this. We didn't have this one, didn't make this slide yesterday, in part because he's promising, you know, coming attractions kind of thing, and we're going to get there. But it relates to the first part of the next text. Here he's describing Abhideya. What's Abhideya? Who knows what Abhideya is? The process. Process of what? Process of devotional service. Okay. Acting within one's relationship. There's the relationship, sambandha, and there's acting within the relationship. What do you do when you're in that relationship with Krishna? Devotional service. The process of devotional service. So here he's describing that the avideya, the influence of devotional service, is a function of the internal energy which overcomes the power of the external energy. Illusion. They're distinct. In the second verse, that's this Atmarama verse, the qualities of Krishna prove themselves the highest functions of his internal energy by their superiority to even the bliss of Brahma. That means Shukadeva Goswami, who was already fully Brahman realized, studied Srimad Bhagavatam. And if you're already there, what do you need to practice something for? You're already there. So he was in the stage of Brahman realization, but became attracted to something that was not material. Krishna is not material, and the internal potency is not material. Not even a tinge of it is material. And then he concludes this little text. Vyas makes no mention of seeing the Purusha feature or the Brahman feature in his state of trance, again, because it's implied. What's that? The Purusha, who has this upadi, or that he's the predominator of Maya, is a partial appearance of the Supreme Lord, and Brahman is his formless and personal aspect. So he's going to deal with those two aspects, particularly in the Paramatma Sandarbha and Bhagavat Sandarbha. So that concludes text 31, and that concludes the 1.7.4. So that's our review. Let's bear in mind why is he doing this? He wants to show that the Bhagavatam teaches Mahaprabhu's philosophy. Mahaprabhu's philosophy is the absolute truth is Bhagavan, a person with unlimited potencies, and the living entities are meant to restore their relationship with him to the linking process of devotional service. Is that what is in the Bhagavatam? Well, this passage shows that. In Baladev Vidyabhusan's commentary, he helps us understand the comparison between Maya and the internal potency. The Maya potency is inferior, the Swarup Shakti is superior, and the reason is Maya associates with the contaminated rebellious souls, so the Lord doesn't directly contact her. In fact, she keeps herself at a distance, out of his sight, he says. Baladeva offers an analogy. It's very similar to what Bhaktisiddhanta writes in Brahma Samhita. The internal energy is like an emperor's favorite queen, and the external energy is like a maid servant, spelled wrong, who always stays outside his quarters. Yes? So it's similar, very similar to Mahavishnu, who is enjoying with Ramadevi, his internal potency, within. That's his yoga nidra. She is with him, and together they're enjoying eternal pastimes together. But she, Ramadevi, has a maid servant. Exactly the language that Bhaktisiddhanta uses in Brahma Samhita. She's also a queen, or she's a direct potency, as it says across the top, a personal potency of the Supreme Lord. But it's the reflection. She is the reflection of his internal potency. It's his Maya potency. So his only contact with her is at a distance he glances. And she does her thing. We'll hear some more about her thing. That's the next verse. So let's chant the verse together. Yaya samohito jiva atmanam trigunatmakam paropi mannute nartam tat kritam chabi padyate. Translation. Due to this external energy, the living entity, although transcendental through the three modes of material nature, thinks himself as a material product and thus undergoes the reactions of material miseries. So in case you wonder, why is it that we suffer? There it is. So we've heard the Parama Purusha. He saw Krishna, his internal potency. He saw the external potency. Now he's seeing the marginal potency. He's also seeing the bondage effect that the three gunas, the three modes of nature, have upon him. He's seeing all this. And the miseries that they're undergoing. So now there's three parts to this Anuched, or text. And the first one begins with a general overall explanation of the verse. The verse beginning, Yaya Samohito Jiva. The process, what's that? Devotional service, Abhideya. And the goal, well, the goal is being in one's relationship, loving service with Bhagavan, are based upon the fact that there are these differences between the Lord and the living entity. Part of this section, he's going to get into smashing Mayavad philosophy, where they say something other than what Vyasa says, although Vyasa is their authority. Is that right? Yeah? Who's the authority of Shankara? Vyasa. Because following Buddhism, he reestablished the authority of the Vedas. And who gave the Vedas? Vyasa. So here's Vyasa's realization. And if Shankaracharya or anybody that claims to be a follower of Vyasa says something other than Vyasa, then, you know, they get in the penalty box. That misunderstanding needs to be corrected or rejected. But he's not there yet. He's just laying the ground that there is a difference, essential difference between the Lord and the living entity. The living entity is the one that's bewildered, and the Lord is not bewildered. The Lord has all these potencies. The living entity is deluded by one of those potencies. That Sri Vyasa saw this distinction is shown in this verse. What's that? Although the living entity is by nature pure spirit, transcendental to the modes of nature, he gets deluded by those modes of nature. He thinks himself a product of these three modes. And deluded in that way, he suffers misery and then repeated birth and death. So then in the next subsection of this text, he goes through these terms, manute, yaya samohito jiva, atmanam trigunatmakam. And then, paropi, manute. He's taking the terms of the text and showing that the living entity is both conscious and consciousness. You've heard Prabhupada say that before? Living entity is conscious and consciousness. You're agreeing? Okay, he's just... Okay, so... The jiva, so that's... Here's Gopi's text in his translation of Jiva Goswami's writing. Furthermore, so what's the furthermore? First is the living entity is transcendental, but it becomes covered by Maya. Furthermore, not only does the living entity consist of pure spiritual consciousness, but he also possesses consciousness of as a component of his essential nature. What does that mean? Just like a light. So light gives illumination, but it also illumines other things. Living entity is conscious and has consciousness. Like Prabhupada says, consciousness spreads throughout the body. So the presence of the soul that's within the body. So the soul is conscious and consciousness. Consciousness within the body is evidence of the soul. That the living entity possesses consciousness is implied in this verse by the word. So there's three references. Yaya samohita. He's conscious. He's deluded. How can you be deluded if you're not conscious? And manute, he considers. You know, it's like Descartes. Brilliant. I think. Therefore I exist. Consciousness is a symptom of the presence that, the fact that I exist. Consciousness and the conscious self. And Krishna indicates the same in Bhagavad Gita. What's that? Living entities are bewildered because their consciousness is covered by ignorance. So there's three references to support his statement. And the statement is, living entity is both conscious and consciousness. Whoops. Thus is refuted the Mayavad idea. There's different types of Mayavadis, by the way, which he gets into. But one of them is that there's no such thing as a jiva. The idea that there's a jiva is just an imposition or an upadhi that's superimposed upon Brahman. And what's liberation? You just give up the idea that I exist as a jiva. And you're Brahman. That's all. That's all you have to do. I'm not going to go into the detail here, but just a quick snippet is one of the categories of Mayavadis is the category that says Brahman, which is can't be divided, gets divided. Note, it's a contradiction. That which can't be divided becomes divided by upadhi, like a pot that you put on the floor, and inside the pot there's space, and outside the pot there's space, and you break the pot, and there's no more space within the pot, all there is space. So, similarly, a jiva is, there's no such thing. All it is Brahman thinking that I'm a jiva. Of course, most jivas don't think they're a jiva. They think they're a product of the three modes of nature. They think they're their body. But you break that upadhi conception and you become God. Om Namo Narayanaya. Hari Bol, Prabhu. Hari Bol, Narayan. And Jiva Goswami writes here in this Yaya Samohita verse, the phrase Yaya Samohito shows that it is Maya alone who is responsible for deluding the living being. The Lord remains uninvolved. He's not responsible for our being in Maya. We are. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. Also, living entity creates his own good fortune, ill fortune by proper use or improper use of free will. Sadasadyoni Janmasu, chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita. But just here in this verse, Yaya Samohito, that's, the Mayam Cha Tadapashram, it's that Maya that bewilders the living entity. Okay. So that's, as you see, very, very far left at the bottom. This is text 32.2. And he goes on, the next little subsection, 32.3. Again, in the Srimad Bhagavatam 2.5.13, there is this statement, the illusory energy of the Lord cannot stand in front of him, being ashamed of her position. But those who are bewildered by her always talk nonsense, being absorbed in thoughts of I and mine. So, it's emphasizing the fact that Maya covers the jiva, and what is her position? In the verse of 2531, there's this Vilajamanaya. She's feeling shame. Why? She knows that the living entities, Krishna wants the living entities to come to him in loving service. He wants them to do that. What is she doing? She's bewildering them and covering them, and she knows that Supreme Lord wants this other. But she does because she can't tolerate. They've turned their backs on him. You stay away from him. So she feels it's her service. She's only doing her service. She has nothing to be ashamed of. A nice example often given is a benevolent state that in order to protect innocent citizens, law-abiding citizens, they have a police force, and if someone breaks the law, they put the person that breaks the law in a prison. You know, this is the benevolent state, not some of the other kinds. So the purpose of the prison is to protect the innocent citizens from people that would harm the innocent law-abiding citizens. To restrain, confine the law-breaking persons. Now they, ideally, a person in such a situation, they don't delight in, get some sadistic pleasure from locking people up in bars or something. You know, certainly people do get some sadistic pleasure doing that. But in an ideal situation, you know, Maya doesn't derive happiness from doing that. She wants to be in the Lord's service. This is the service that's assigned to her. She does her service, but she's still feeling ashamed. And she does this service in relation to those who are ignorant of him or averse to him. And that aversion, he uses this word anadi, which we're not going to entertain any questions about this evening. Srimad Bhagavatam, he goes on, describes the results of the jiva's turning from the Lord. If you don't know this verse, it's a good verse to learn. It's a well-known, often quoted verse. Ayam dvitiya binivesitak syat. Prabhupada would quote it often. It describes what's the result of the living entities who being attracted to something other than the all-attractive. What a misfortune. They become fearful. Bhayam. Dvati. Dvati means a second. There isn't a second. But they think there is. So they become attracted to something that isn't. And then it's a fearful position because it's not a tenable one. It's not a sustainable, even real one. But they're attracted. It's really sad. Like somebody that has an addiction. They know the thing that they're addicted to is destroying them, and they're addicted to it. What a misfortune. It's a fearful state, and they're just like free fall, and a crash at the end. So Maya is taking care of that service on behalf of the Parama Purusha. Therefore, Maya covers their real nature and entices them to identify with matter. And I think there's just one more slide for this evening. Two more. So he goes on. So he's covering this sambandha, abhideya, prayojana, because these are the, as in Vedanta Sutra, those of you that are familiar with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's talks with Prakash Ananda Saraswati. Do you know who is Prakash Ananda Saraswati? He was a Mayavadi sannyasi. He was a big dude. He had many, many students. All of them were sannyasis. And he was the leader of all of them. And when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came passing through Benares or Varanasi, on his way to Vrindavan, they mocked him and laughed at him and ridiculed him. And then when he came back through after being in Vrindavan, the devotees came to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and said, we can't tolerate it. They're ridiculing you and scorning you, and it's too painful for us to have this go on. Please do something. So he did something. He made Prakashananda Saraswati into a devotee. And how did he do that? Wonderful pastime, making it short. Just as he said that to his devotees in Varanasi, a brahmana came and invited him to come to have lunch with all the other Mayavadi sannyasis. And of course, Mahaprabhu would never accept such an invitation, but he accepted the invitation. And when he went, they were all assembled, and he sat right by the foot wash, which is considered a dirty place. And then he exhibited his Brahman effulgence. And they went, wow, look at that Brahman effulgence. We're attracted. So they invited him to come sit in their midst. And Prakashananda began to speak and said, why don't you do what sannyasis are supposed to do? You're supposed to study Vedanta Sutra. Instead, you're doing things that sannyasis aren't supposed to do. You're associating with worldly people and partying all the time, singing and dancing and carrying on like you're an ordinary fellow, but you're sannyasi. Why are you doing this? And he said, well, because my spiritual master told me. Chant Hare Krishna. And when I started chanting Hare Krishna, something happened. I just started dancing and crying and rolling on the ground, and I went to him and said, I must be doing something wrong. And he said, no, you're doing everything right. And quoted a verse from the Bhagavatam saying, it's right. This is the topmost stage. Bless you. Keep going. And a little discussion on Vedanta Sutra, because in his Leela, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, before he became a devotee, was super scholar, defeating all the other scholars. He was renowned for his scholarship. He's the Supreme Lord. There's no scholar better than him. So he explained Vedanta Sutra to Prakashananda Saraswati, overheard by whatever it was, 1,000 sannyasis. Must have had a loudspeaker system or something. How can you? Anyway. And he explained the Vedanta Sutra in terms of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So that's what's going on here. Jiva Goswami is presenting Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. In terms of Vyasa's realization, there's Sambandha, the relationship of all things in terms of the source of all those things. And what is their relationship with that source of those things? And then he's in this verse number 5 is indicating the linking process for the living entities to restore their original consciousness. His statement is, bhakti is logically inferred. Here's how he writes. Since the Supreme Lord and the Jiva have thus have distinct identities, the Lord being the foundation of Maya and the Jiva being deluded by her, we can conclude that devotional service to the Lord is the only recommended method for self-realization. That's going to be the next verse. This conclusion follows logically from such scriptural statements as the following ones in Bhagavad Gita, 7:14, this divine energy of mind, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. Only those who engage in Abhideya, The linking process, devotional service, can cross beyond it. So it's implied. Three times now he's brought out the internal potency, although the internal potency isn't directly named, it's implied. The effulgence around the full moon, the linking process of devotional service, and love of God is the prayojana. The personality of Godhead is the most deserving recipient of perfect love because he instructs all people about their ultimate welfare. That comes in Vyasadeva in the statement that after Vyasa understood all these things, he compiled Srimad Bhagavatam and taught it because he was compassionate. That's why he compiled the Vedas to begin with, because he's compassionate. And now when he had this realization, he didn't become less compassionate, more compassionate. So the personality of Godhead instructs all people about their ultimate welfare. He removes all sorrows. He is everyone's supreme self, like the sun in relation to its rays. And he is perfectly endowed with all wonderful qualities. Thus is established the final goal of all endeavor. So that's going to come in the very next verse. These are later verses 44 and 45, but there's indication of them earlier. And that's what we're going to do tomorrow. Let's chant the verse together for tomorrow. Anartho pashamam sakshad bhakti yogam adhoksaje lokasya jadatha vidvangs chakre satvata samhitam. Translation. The material miseries of the living entity which are superfluous to him can be directly mitigated by the linking process of bhakti yoga, devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth, Chakra Satvata Samhitam. So we'll hear more about that verse tomorrow. Isn't it nice to end on time? Any comments or questions? Jai Jagannath? Mukunda?
Hare Krishna. I had a question about the slide where you mentioned about the soul as being consciousness and also having the attribute of consciousness.
Yeah. Okay. That's nice, isn't it? What's your question?
Then it says, thus the argument is refuted that the upadhi of the jiva
covered Brahman.
Is,
the jiva, there's no such thing as jiva, it's just covered Brahman.
Yeah, I just didn't understand it. I didn't understand how that refutes that argument.
The jiva is conscious, standing on its own. The jiva is conscious, standing on its own. Covering, no covering. The jiva is conscious, standing on its own. It's not, you know, a state of covered Brahman. It's conscious, standing on its own. Covered or uncovered. It's like, you know, there's a candle inside a candle holder. And over there is a bonfire. This isn't dependent upon the bonfire, it's just standing on its own. And you can break the covering, the glass around the candle holder thing. It's still, you know, a candle, and there's the bonfire. Standing on its own, the living entity isn't covered Brahman only, just break the upadhi and it loses its identity. There's no such thing as a living entity, to begin with or in the future. No such thing. My body's idea.
I had a question about, like, first slide, one of the first slides.
The very first slide?
One, you had, it was mentioned on the bottom of the slide how Jiva Goswami or the Goswamis were giving the core tenets of the Sampradaya.
Yeah.
And particularly the Sundarbhas were systematizing the Bhagavatam for us.
Both.
Both. So my question is, Srila Prabhupada, his commentaries on the Bhagavatam, is a Gaudiya commentary to
yes,
the Bhagavatam.
It is. Yes.
As opposed to like a Sri Vaishnava commentary.
Yes.
And as such, the way I'm thinking about it these days, it seems logical that it would be easier for us to assimilate what Srila Prabhupada was discussing if we actually knew what the core tenets of the Sampradaya were. Because oftentimes in our experience in the beginning of reading Prabhupada's books, it seems like he's just all over the place in the beginning. That was my experience at least, and I also hear that from many devotees as well. And then when we start to learn more of the philosophy, we can realize, oh, Prabhupada...
That's that, and that's that, and that's that.
So it seems that it makes sense that when, as Jiva Goswami is writing this to introduce the world to Gaudiya theology, it seems that it would make sense to have this sort of being taught even in the very beginning, like the Sundarbhas. These are our core tenets. And then when we go to study Prabhupada's books, we would actually have an easier way to assimilate and digest them. So I'm wondering about this, if this is correct. And I'm thinking in contrast of like our Bhakti Shastri program and our Bhakti Bhai Bhav and so on. And then oftentimes we go like really deep into the purports and so on, but we're not standing on solid ground yet. So then going so deep, it kind of creates confusion. So I was...
I'll say the same thing in two different ways, and you can probably say it a number of other ways. When feeding babies, generally it's pablum, because the capacity for a baby to digest food is not what an adult can do to digest food. So it's pablumized. It's readily swallowable and easily digestible. And that's what Prabhupada did. He pablumized that which, if it was more systematized, people would be anemic. I mean, you know, they wouldn't approach it. That's my sense. He did it purposefully. Purposefully. He took very elevated subject matters and made it really smooth and easy. So, when reading that smooth and easy, they may not understand and recognize the system. But it's just readily swallowable and very easy to digest. Some people find it's really hard to read Prabhupada's books. What to speak of, you know, they wouldn't touch the Sundarbhas. It's like, you know, forget it, man. I'm out of here. Give me something. So even with Prabhupada's books, we have to find ways to pablumize the pablum. And even make bridges so that, you know, they don't even know what's going on and then they get something and like that. So, knowing, you know, so his audience was the world. Jiva Goswami's audience is the highly elevated intellectual scholars of his time. That's, you know, the systematic approach that he took. Now, could somebody like you or, you know, I'm imagining that you'll wish to present these systematic presentations to our newer devotees so that they're prepared. And, you know, the audience might shrink from those that, so it may be needed for those that are wishing to continue and understand the system of things and then go back, as has happened for you and me and those that have studied, you know, the more rigorous parts of our Goswami literatures and lay them out So that, you know, the pablum of, or the easily digestible messages of Prabhupada's purports, you go, oh, that's what that is. And that's where that comes from. I went through this period, maybe like 6 months, where I was analyzing every single sentence in Prabhupada's purports as a reference to something. Sometimes he'll make commentary like, you know, current events. But other than those current event type of things, it's just paraphrasing something from our acharyas or from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam verse. Sentence by sentence by sentence. And he just stitched it all together so it made it smooth. So we were getting the Sandarbhas and its message without, you know, the rigors of the system itself. I think of it like that. It, you know, the audience, he understood the audience, give something that's very systematic and they're going to run the other way. Give something that's very simple and plausible and, you know, logical, there's logic to it. It flows. Very eloquent and elegant. And people love it. People that like philosophy. People that like reading spiritual literature. Anyway. When I was in college, I studied German for 2 years. When I was in high school, I studied French for 5 years. In fact, I started even before I got into high school. And I never used it, so I never could speak it. But I went distributing books in Puerto Rico, and in about 6 months, I was, you know, I could have a regular conversation with people. Although I didn't know anything about the structure of the language. Now, if I had known the structure of the language, I would be speaking with people different than how people speak with each other, because I would be speaking in the proper way rather than how people speak to each other. So it's kind of like that.
I was thinking of the context of getting educated. Like when devotees are going to the next step and they're wanting to be educated. So then already the circle is decreasing. You know, because now they're not just wanting the gist, they're wanting to be educated.
Yes.
So then, I don't think, at least as far as my knowledge is concerned, I don't think we have anything yet set up to teach devotees like all these core tenets of the philosophy for that smaller group who are actually wanting to be educated in these things.
Well, yeah, you're right. Well, you know, the literature that Prabhupada gave us is Srimad Bhagavatam. So, you know, if someone goes through Bhakti Vaibhav after Bhakti Shastri and Bhakti Vedanta, that's another approach to you get that comprehensive presentation. Then go on to the Sandarbhas. But, you know, then he had us go on to Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, and again, because the Sandarbhas is nothing but Srimad Bhagavatam presented systematically and comprehensively, I had a little chat with Devaki Nandan from Juhu, and he said, because he likes the Bhagavatam and he does Bhagavat Katha, he said, I read the entire in Hindi, I read the entire Bhagavat Sat Sandarbhas. It went right over my head. So someone's going to teach, and he's not slow. He's teaching the Srimad Bhagavatam. So take your brahmacharis, that wish to go to that other level. And if it's not going to be Bhakti Vaibhav, Bhakti Vedanta, and whatever the next one is, Bhakti something. Sarvabhoma, okay, Sarvabhoma. Chaitanya Charitamrita. then you're going to have, you or whoever's the teacher is going to have to be, you're going to have to pablumize to some extent. Certainly have to have assimilated. I mean, one of the things, one of the glories of Jiva Goswami is not only he was scholarly, but he could teach. Some people that are scholarly, they can't teach. I was teaching one time, I mean, anecdotal, I was teaching one time in the VIHE, and I was teaching Dasamula Tattva by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And another class was Gopi Pranadana was teaching Tattva Sandarbha, so I took his class. And then a third class that I was taking, but I quit because he didn't know how to teach, was Mukunda Maharaj, was teaching communications. But he didn't know how to teach it. He knows his stuff inside out, backwards and forwards in his sleep, upside down. But he couldn't teach it. He was in the class emptied out. So he sat in and took Borijan's Art of Teaching class because he didn't know how to teach. Or, you know, it's a classic, you know, very, very elevated scholarly scientist type people. No one can understand what they're saying. They wonder even if they can understand what they're saying, but they can't communicate it. It's common. Highly intellectual people commonly can't teach. And people can teach are not necessarily highly intellectual. So to put those two together, it's very special. Sariputta was one who could do both. Rare. Anyway. Good luck. And then, you know, to teach it, to find a teacher. Do you learn it so then you can teach it? And then, you know, that has its challenge. Because there's some people that are teachers that are cheaters. And teachers that are misleaders. And you'll go into an alley and they'll beat you up. You don't even, you know, you, anyway. So it's a challenge. That's why I'm, you know, happy that Gopi did what he did. When I took Gopi's course, however many years ago, he was still writing. He didn't even have a manuscript yet, so he used Stuart Elkman's translation. Stuart Elkman is a fellow at University of something or other that did his PhD thesis on Tattva Sandarbha. And his scholarship was very good. And this is what Jiva Goswami says. This is what Baladev Vidyabhusan says in his commentary of Jiva Goswami. And then he wrote his Mayavad commentary. When he finished Tattva Sandarbha, he went to Sringeri Math and took sannyas. Although he was translating with reasonably good scholarship, Tattva Sandarbha. Watch out. No, he had enough integrity that he properly represented what Baladev said. And then he would bash Baladev and say he's a bad person because he misled the people. He said this about Jiva Goswami, but actually something else. Thumbed his nose at Baladev and became a Mayavadi. So one has to be very careful. We can teach not just intellectual and academic things. We have to teach from devotion. That's a high qualification. Okay, so anything else? Anybody? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. I'm a little confused here. In order for us to be devoted and truly live our relationship with God, do we have to be scholars? Do we have to be philosophers?
No.
Learn the whole thing up and down?
It's not a prerequisite. It's not that you can't go back to Godhead if this stuff is something that you don't thoroughly understand and get an A in your exam. That's not required. Did that answer your question? Like, the classic example is from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Leela, the brahmana who was illiterate. Not only he wasn't a high philosopher, he couldn't even read. But he was the true scholar of Bhagavad Gita, because he understood the heart of Krishna by dint of his devotion to Krishna. So if the answer to your question is no, it's not necessary, then why are you wasting our time? Are we wasting our time?
No.
Oh, okay. Because these are impetuses for sake of clarity, further illumine and put in really sharp focus what the process of bhakti is, what the goal of the process of bhakti is, what it looks like, what it doesn't look like, you know, what are deviations from it. So we can, you know, the inspired impetuses for reaching the goal, effectively, guided by our great acharyas. Sri Sri Kishor Kishori Ki Jai. Okay? Anything else? We're done. Okay. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.